Tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off last week in the book of Leviticus, chapter 27. We're going to be finishing this book tonight, Lord willing. It's only 34 verses, but it's a completion of this book. And the book of Leviticus is really a very, very difficult book to wade through. But, I think that in spite of a lot of the difficulties, for me personally, it always is a blessing to be able to really comprehend and understand how this applies in terms of our own spiritual growth and our own spiritual welfare, and also how it applies to Christ and his person and his work and our redemption. All of this points to Christ and our salvation and our relationship with God. And so I do think that even though it may appear to be on the surface irrelevant to us today, I still think it has a great deal of application if we just take the opportunity to read it, because it's like so many other things that in the Bible. It's like, I often think of it as like going through a diamond mine or a gem mine, and sometimes, to get your most valuable gems, you really have to do a lot of digging. You really have to do a lot of work to get it. And the book of Leviticus certainly falls into that category, because it's not real meaty on the surface, but I do think there's a lot of spiritual applications that can be drawn from it, when you really begin to dig deep. Okay, and it's concluding chapter 27. Deals primarily with vows that people make to God. Now, most of what we dealt with, what we are required to do in our relationship with God as far as tithing, or as far as what kind of animals to sacrifice and the kind of condition they needed to be in, and all of these things were set forth in Leviticus as what God would require of us. Now we're dealing in this concluding chapter with basically what people would vow to God. And when we read this, I think one overlying thread or theme that runs through this, I think that we need to get a hold of, is the fact that, hey, God is in heaven and we are on earth, and God is divine and we are just human. I mean, he's infinite and we are finite. And I think that even the church today has lost sight of the fact that we are dealing with an all-consuming fire. He is not to be trifled with. He is not to be brought down to our human level. And unfortunately, even in our churches today, we see a lot of this, where God is just made out to be some kind of celestial chum or some kind of eternal Santa Claus, some kind of celestial butler. I mean, and we really do, I think, miss the essence of what we're dealing with here. I mean, God is a God of love. He's a God of mercy, and he's a God of forgiveness, and he's a God that we can certainly enter into a personal relationship with. But we can never lose sight of the fact that he is an all-consuming fire and needs to be given the utmost respect, and he needs to be feared. And when we read these various vows, even though they don't apply today, there's still the spiritual application of our relationship with God and how we deal with him, because everything has consequences. And if our tongue causes us to sin, it's going to have a consequence to it. Because when we vow to God, when we say we're going to do something, we have to do our absolute utmost to see that through. We can't be flippant in our relationship with God. And I think that this is what this main thing, if there was one theme for this chapter 27, it's do not trifle with God. Do not be flippant with God in your relationship with him. Okay, it says here in that verse 1, again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man makes a difficult vow, he shall be valued according to your valuation of persons belonging to the Lord. If your valuation is one of a male of 20 years, even to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver, after the shekel of the sanctuary. Or if it is a female, then your valuation shall be 30 shekels. And if it be from the 5 years even to 20 years old, then your valuation for the male shall be 20 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. But if they are from a month even up to 5 years old, then your valuation shall be 5 shekels of silver for the male, and for the female your valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. And if they are from 60 years old and upward, if it is a male, then your valuation shall be 15 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. But if he is poorer than your valuation, then he shall be placed before the priest, and the priest shall value him according to the means of the one who has vowed. The priest shall value him. Okay, now, when we just read here, in this first 8 verses, I think a lot of people just scratch their head and say, what is this all about? First of all, it almost seems very, very discriminatory, because, women are given less value than men. But we got to understand what this is all about. You know what this is about? This is what you vow something. For example, if you say to God, I want to give something above and beyond my tithe. So I'm going to vow to the Lord my son or my daughter or myself. What that means is you would go to the priest, and depending upon your age and depending upon your sex, there was a valuation put upon you. And that valuation was determined by how much work you could do for the Lord. In other words, it was almost the value of, I don't want to say a slave, but simply a hired hand. How much are you worth as far as your work ability is concerned? And this is why women have less value than men. Not because God looks at women differently in terms of their intrinsic value, but their ability to work hard labor. I mean, I know there are some women who are maybe stronger than some men, but the way that God has created men and women, women are the weaker sex. Men can do a great deal more physical labor than women. What this is determined by is just simply how much work is a person capable of doing. Physical work, labor, all right? That's all that's determined there. Now, granted, women can do a lot of different things better than a man, but what's dealing with here is the hired hand. So God takes this valuation and he says, okay, a man of certain age, he's going to be worth so much money. So this is what they do. They determine the value of a particular individual, and then they would take that money that the person would be worth, and then they would donate it to the sanctuary. The person themselves would not be dedicated to the Lord, but just the value of the person. If the person went up to the priest and said, I would like to vow myself to God, he'd say, okay, so you're 22, you're a male, you're pretty strong, you get so much work out of you, this is how much you would be worth. So then he pays this to God in a monetary sum to the sanctuary, to the priest. This is above and beyond the tithe. And God even made a provision here for just simply saying that if a person wanted to vow themselves, but they didn't have the means in which to do that, then the priest himself, if you look at that verse 8, it says, but if he is poorer than your valuation, then he shall be placed before the priest, and the priest shall value him according to the means the one vowed. The priest shall value him. So, in other words, God has made a provision here that if you want to vow yourself or you wanted to vow a family member to God, but you didn't have the money as far as how much it would be cost you, then the priest would look at your means, and he would say, well, okay, according to your means, this is what this person would be worth. And then you give that to God, and God would accept that as a total vow. The thing that I'm trying to stress here is that, you know, God, okay, is saying, if you want to do something, that's fine, and I'll be very pleased, and I'll bless you for it, and I'll be honored by what you do. But keep something in mind. When we're dealing with God, and especially in areas of vows, in Proverbs, chapter 20, verse 25, Solomon says, it is a snare for a man to say rashly, it is holy, and after the vow, make inquiry. In other words, there's a warning here that we are not to be hasty in our words when it comes to what we say we're going to do. Like, you know, we hardly ever have any funds, for example, in the Bible study fund, because, you know, we don't have a whole lot of expenses, but we do. But over the years, we have done a great deal in terms of, you know, sending Bibles to Russia and trying to get to evangelize, you know, do the evangelism in Russia, you know, and how much it's cost us over the years to do that. We kind of were committed to that, and then the Soviet Union all, you know, fell apart, and now we no longer are involved in that because they have a lot more freedom than they used to have. Okay, so we also basically committed to sponsoring, you know, a child in Guatemala as a Bible study. Okay, and every single month of paying $24 a month, and we did that for many, many years until the kid was 18 years old. And then after that was done, we said, okay, maybe we Bible study could help evangelize in China. So we've been given $30 a month to Trans World Radio, which specifically targets China. Now, this is what the Bible study has committed to. Now, granted, we hardly have any money in there, so every month I usually just pay it. But basically, we have vowed that. Okay, we didn't sit down and say, Lord, you know, Lord, we vow this to do this. But we kind of committed as a Bible study to do it. So, you know, we kind of see these things through and take it very seriously. Like it says in Ecclesiastes, this is another warning, because Solomon says this in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. He says, guard your steps as you go into the house of God. Draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know what they are doing. The offer of sacrifice of fools would be to make a vow that even though with their good intentions they intend to pay, but then, you know, when the emotional high is gone, then they don't pay. I seen this up at the retreat, for example. A woman was really, really blessed by the talks, the sermons, the whole retreat. And so she gave like a check, I think it was $55. But then, after it was all over and done, I think that she had called up somebody and says, you know, I wanted my money back. And that was fine. I just sent her money back. But I just thought, boy, you know, she was on an emotional high when she gave that, I guess, and then decided, well, you know, a lot of times people just, you know, get caught up in the moment and they don't think these things through. And so that's why Solomon's saying there, guard your steps when you go into the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer a sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. He says, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For the dream comes through much effort and the voice of a fool through many words. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow then you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of a messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. Rather fear God. Now, I'll give you an example. Okay, now, we got in a situation today where 50% of marriages end up in divorce. Okay, and Christian marriage is about the same. Now, anybody that's had a divorce, I'm certainly not saying it's an unforgivable sin, but we do have to call an ace a spade a spade. When two Christians go up to the altar and they vow before God and before everybody else that they're going to, you know, love their spouse till death do them part, that's a vow. And how many of those vows are broken? How many of those vows are discarded? Well, what we're dealing with here is a God that we need to fear. And even though every marriage is going to, you know, end up, you know, having a lot of difficulties and trials and setbacks and disappointments and disillusionments and heartbreaks to it, I think that we really do need to say, okay, come hell or high water, you know, I made this vow to this person and to before God, and I'm going to do my utmost to make this thing work. That's what God looks for. Okay, and he will reward that and he will bless that. But of course, today, we always cop for the easy way out. When I say we, I mean most people just cop for that, okay? And any Christian, anybody that has had a divorce, you know, it's not an unforgivable sin. We all fail. We all fall short of the glory of God. I'm just simply saying that, hey, we really do need to take these things serious, you know? When you see people that have been divorced 2, 3, 4, 5 times, I mean, they're not really taking things super serious, are they? Mm-hmm. And they're bringing judgment upon themselves in that regard.
I'd like to say, too, that it does take two, and there may be that one that said that vow, meant that vow, was committed to that vow.
Good.
And then, you know, there's always that one that no matter what, they're not going to be obedient to them.
Right. Hey, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up because that's very, very true. It takes two to make that work. And if one person just cops out on it, then the other person, you know, is just left holding the bags. But, you know, I don't think that other person is going to be held accountable before God. But again, you know, only God knows. There's two sides to every story, and only God is going to be able to be the judge in that. I'm certainly not trying to be anybody's judge. I'm just using it as an example of whether it's marital vows or, let's say, ordination vows or commitments to children or your parents or whatever, that type of thing. You know, we really do need to take that a great deal more serious because it's just reading this, you can see that God wants us to always have a sense of reverence and fear and accountability and responsibility to him and to each other. And then he says here in verse 9, says, now if it is an animal of the kind which men can present as an offering to the Lord, any such one that one gives to the Lord shall be holy. In other words, this is above and beyond your tithe. It's above and beyond, let's say, anything you wanted to offer to God as a burnt offering, a whole offering, a peace offering, whatever. You know, just something that you wanted to give to God. He said that that even when he gives it, it's considered to be holy unto the Lord. And then in verse 10, he says that he shall not replace it or exchange it, a good for a bad or a bad for a good. Or if he does exchange the animal for an animal, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. So in other words, a person says, picks a particular animal, a sheep out of his flock, says, I want to vow this to the Lord. And even if he finds out that the sheep later has a defect, God says, you can't even exchange it, even if it was bad. Now, this isn't for an offering. This is something that you vow to the Lord. In other words, you give it to the priest, and the priest uses it. It's for the sanctuary, or you give it to the priest, and the priest uses it for his own means, for his own livelihood. But if you decide, well, I wanted to give something better than that, God says, then you have to give both of them. Okay, you can't exchange a better one for a worse one, and you certainly can't change a worse one for a better one. See what I'm saying? In other words, God does not want us to be manipulating around at all. If you're going to vow something, pay what you vowed. And if you want to exchange that for any reason, then the one you're going to exchange with, you got to give them both. Mm-hmm. What does that say to us? It says, man, even if our intentions is to be, you know, even if it's good, it's still something he's instilling in us, is that, hey, there's a cost involved here when you vow something. And we're not to change the game plan. Otherwise, going to cost us more. Yeah.
I think it also deals with that emotional thing, that God wants none of that. He wants
good
us
point.
To haul the line that we say we're going to haul and stick to it. If you all of a sudden get on an emotional high and want to give more, well, that's just like the other way.
Right. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. Very good point. Because that really hits the nail on the head. We're not to be hasty in what we vow or in our speech and our dealings with God. You know, I know that when I started this Bible study, I didn't vow to God, Lord, I'm going to vow that I'm going to teach this Bible study, you know, every single week. Mm-hmm. It's going on 29 years. But what I'm saying is this. I didn't vow to God, but I determined in my own heart that I was going to sit here and read this word even if nobody showed up, okay, for my own edification. But it was a commitment that I made myself. Come hell or high water, feel like it or not, I'm committed to this. But I didn't want to be hasty in my speech and say, I vow I'm going to do this for X number of years, because to me that would be foolish. I just determined with the grace of God this is what I was going to do. And I think a lot of times that's what we probably should do, rather than do something on an emotional high and make, like Kevin said, make decisions based on emotion rather than determination that this is what I'm going to see this through thick or thin. And it says here in verse 11, it says, if, however, if it is an unclean animal of the kind which men do not present as an offering to the Lord, then he shall place the animal before the priest, and the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As you, the priest, shall value it, so shall it be. But if he should ever wish to redeem it, then he shall add one-fifth of it to your valuation. So what he's basically saying here is this. An unclean animal was something you couldn't offer to God on the altar. But let's just simply say you had a camel that you wanted to vow to the Lord. Well, you bring it to the priest and say, well, that camel's worth 30 shekels. Okay, well, it's 30 shekels. So you take the valuation of that animal and you give it to the sanctuary. And then the priest apparently gets to keep the animal. All right? But for its own use. But if you wanted the animal back from the priest, well, you could buy an unclean animal back, but you had to have added a fifth of the price to it. Showing that, okay, this is something that's really, really going to be costly. So if you make a vow, as far as God is concerned, you need to keep that vow. I don't want to beat that to death, but I think that's the overriding theme throughout this, is that when we want to do something for God, we need to take it serious and we need to see it through. If, like, for example, if you commit to, let's say, teaching Sunday school at church, and you're going to teach it for a semester or for a year, well, man, you have to really see that through. Come hell or high water, thick or thin, you need to see that through. Now, if you have to move away or something like that, you still need to make arrangements that you're going to see this through. You just can't say, get all enthused, let's say, about, you know, committing yourself to serving the Lord and teaching a Bible study or teaching a Sunday school. And then somebody steps on your toes, it looks like you're cross-eyed, and then you just go out on a big huff I'm not going to do this anymore. Because basically, you had committed to that. That commitment to that is the same thing as a vow as far as God is concerned. When you commit yourself to do something in, for the honor and glory of God, we need to see that through. Like it or not, feel like it or not. And that's what God wants us to really instill within us, is that kind of commitment to Him. And I think that one of the things that's so frustrating today is when you see so many Christians that are just people in general, but even in the church is where it really, really can get aggravating, is that people are no longer, you know, in general speaking, people of their word. You know, I mean, it used to be years ago, many years ago, that, you know, a man's word was his bond, right? You could you know, get a loan on a handshake simply by this guy's word is as good as gold.
It was, you know, a contract.
Right. Yeah. Now, what do you got? You got people going to get married. They're going to make these pre-nuptial agreements, and they want to get the lawyers involved, and they make even when they sign all the contracts, you know, to commit to this type of thing. Then they want out, and they want different arrangements. I mean, this is our whole mindset today in this country, and it's carrying over even in our church and even our relationship with God, where we don't take things serious with Him. That's why, you know, I think that this is a very appropriate chapter in terms of emphasizing our need to take God serious and take our commitment and our walk with Him serious. I mean, how many people have made a commitment? Let's say they go to Billy Graham crusade, and Billy Graham makes an altar call, and then you see thousands and thousands of people coming down, you know, to accept the Lord. Well, even Billy Graham has said that, you know, through a great deal of research and follow-up studies, he's saying that only about 10% of the people who come down and make a commitment to God to give their life to Christ, you know, stick with it the rest of their life. And I would say that was certainly a type of vow, a type of commitment to God, when you go up to the altar and kneel down and give your life to Him, right? And then you turn around and go back to your old ways. I mean, that's not keeping a commitment to God. That's not keeping a vow, is it? You see what I'm saying? And this is the type of mindset that we're seeing all over today. And then he says here, in verse 14, now if a man consecrates his house as holy to the Lord, then the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so shall it stand. He could vow his, you know, his personhood. He could vow his animals. He could vow his house. He could vow his property. And basically what that meant is that there would be an estimation by the priest of how much it was worth, and then he would give that money to the sanctuary. That would be vowed unto God. That was above and beyond any type of tithe. And verse 15 says, yet if the one who consecrates it should wish to redeem his house, then he shall add one-fifth of your valuation to the price of it, so that that may be his. So let's just say he gives the house to the priest, or, you know, it's vowed to God, and then he wants to get the house back. He's got to, you know, pay a fifth more than what he paid. If the emphasis, again, is stressing that, hey, this is going to be costly to get out of something that you have committed to. It's going to cost you something. And then he says in that verse 16, he says, again, if a man consecrates to the Lord a part of the field of his own property, then your valuation shall be proportional to the seed needed for it, a homer of barley seed at 50 shekels of silver. If he consecrates his field as of the year of Jubilee, according to your valuation, it shall stand. If he consecrates his field after the Jubilee, however, the priest shall calculate the price for him proportionate to the years that are left until the year of Jubilee, and it shall be deducted from your valuation. And if one who consecrates it should ever wish to redeem the field, then he shall add one-fifth of your valuation to the price, so that it may pass to him. So in other words, we're saying, if you have a field, okay, and you say, well, okay, I'm going to vow a portion of my field, this particular acre of my field is going to be vowed to the Lord. Now, this is above and beyond your tithe. So the priest comes out and says, well, okay, this particular acre, you can sow so much seed in it. So everything that comes up in that field is given to the sanctuary, is given to the priest, is given to God, it's vowed to God. And the determination of the price of that field is basically determined on the year of Jubilee. Okay, we talked about this earlier in our previous chapter, where basically every 50 years, all the land would revert back to its original owner. Basically, it had a spiritual significance pointing to the fact that the whole world would revert back to God at that time in history when Christ comes back to redeem the world. But the time of Jubilee, it all goes back to the original owner. So the valuation of that property or the field had to be determined on how many years left till Jubilee. And so the priest would make that kind of evaluation, and then he would set the price, and then it could be given to God.
And John, is it worth more the farther away it is from the
right,
time of Jubilee?
Right, okay. Right. Like if it was 49 years of Jubilee, it would be worth a great deal. Okay, if it's 1 year away, then it wouldn't be worth nearly as much, simply because it's going to revert back to its original owner. He says, in verse 20, he says, "Yet if he will not redeem the field, but has sold the field to another man, it may no longer be redeemed. And when it reverts in the Jubilee, the field shall be holy to the Lord, like a field that's set apart. It shall be for the priest as his property. Then the priest shall calculate for him the amount of valuation up to the year of Jubilee. He shall add on that day, give your valuation as holy unto the Lord. In the year of Jubilee, the field shall return to the one who from whom he bought it, to whom the possession of the land belongs. Every valuation of yours, moreover, shall be the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel shall be 20 gerahs." This is kind of really confusing here. Okay, but I think basically what he's saying is that if the man vows land to God, and it's just he gives a price, he pays a price for that vow, of the valuation price of the land. Okay, the land apparently is still his in this particular situation. He's just paid what is valued to the Lord. But then if he turns around and sells the land once it's been vowed, then he can't get it back. Again, showing there's a hefty price involved when you vow something to God. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're getting at here is what God is trying to get at here is that not only is there going to be a cost involved, if we don't keep our vow. But this is a consequence of, you know, us changing our mind. I just look around us today and I'm seeing so many consequences of bad decisions. And I know this gets off on a tangent, but it has an application, okay, if we just connect the dots. For example, here we are again with the rash of school shootings. Kids killing kids. For what reason? But then everybody's running around wondering why. That to me, it seems so abundantly clear. Okay, granted, there are a multitude of reasons which will contribute to this. There's no question about it. But basically, it boils down to this, where Paul says in the New Testament, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. A man will reap exactly what he sows. So will a nation," right? Look what we've been sowing. I remember hearing at the time of the Columbine shootings, when all these kids were shot up and killed and wounded and everything else, and some girl, you know, was very distraught, and she basically said, "Why didn't God stop this?" And the guy who was standing beside her says, "Because God's not allowed in our schools anymore." We have reaped what we've sown. And this is what happens when we no longer recognize God as being God. And one of the consequences of that, and it tells us in Romans, is that God gives us over to a depraved mind. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing so much of what's happening today as far as the depravity. But the thing that just gets me is that we could see these school shootings and killings and all these threats and going on, and everybody's wondering, well, what's happening? And it's like, man, we are just reaping what we've sown. How come nobody can put two and two together? It always just amazes me when you read the paper or listen to the news or even on the radio, nobody seems to make the connection that this is the end result of 30 years of trampling God's laws under our foot. And he says in verse 25, "Every valuation of yours, moreover, shall be after the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel shall be 20 gerahs." In other words, it's one standard. You can't change the standard. This is the valuation. It's not going to fluctuate whether a person is rich or poor, whether a person is your friend or not. And a priest has got to make that standard, that it applies to all men. And that's the same thing with us. Okay? God doesn't play favors. We need to have that total respect and reverence and awe for him in our dealings. And in verse 26, it says, "However, the firstborn among animals, which as firstborn belongs to the Lord, no man may consecrate it, whether an ox or a sheep, it is the Lord's." Basically, what he's saying is this. We read in Exodus that the firstborn, everything that opens a womb, belongs to God. That is to be dedicated to God. It belongs to God. So you can't vow it to God. It's like vowing your tithe or something like that. I mean, this is what we owe him. can't pay what we already belongs to him. And then verse 27 says, but if it is among the unclean animals, then he shall redeem it according to your valuation and add one-fifth of it. And if it is not redeemed, then it shall be sold according to your valuation. Okay, if it's something that can't be used on the altar, it can still have value before God as far as monetary value that could be given to God, through the sanctuary, through the priest. Verse 28, nevertheless, any prescribed thing which a man sets apart to the Lord out of all that he has, of a man or an animal or a field of his own property, shall not be sold or redeemed. Every prescribed thing is most holy to the Lord. A prescribed thing is something that's already devoted to the Lord. It's under the ban. It belongs to God. I'll give you an example, I guess, maybe in Joshua. There are certain things that were applied under the ban. For example, when they attacked the city of Ai, then everything belonged to the Lord, but Achan took what didn't belong to him. So anything, in other words, anything that's already, dedicated to God can't be turned around and vowed to God. Okay, because it's simply, it's his. And verse 26, 29 says, no prescribed person who may have been set apart among men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. In other words, no person who is, under the death penalty. If a person is sentenced to die because he's killed another human being, you can't make a valuation on that person. Okay, that person cannot be redeemed, or that person cannot be vowed to God. That person is going to be executed. I think that's what it's referring to here in that verse 29. Verse 30, thus all the tithe of the land and of the seed and of the land of the fruit of the trees is the Lord. It is holy to the Lord. If therefore a man wishes to redeem part of his tithe, he shall add a fifth to it. For every tenth part of a herd or a flock, whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. In other words, when you have a pasture or flock, okay, 10% of it needs to go to God. But the way that they would do it is that, okay, you would take, let's just say you had a pasture full of sheep. You would corral them, to go through a narrow gate. And as they would go through, you would count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Then you'd hit the top of the 10th sheep head with some kind of die from your rod when he passes under the rod. So it's marked out to be God's. Okay. And whether that animal is lame or whether it's good, it doesn't matter. It belongs to the Lord when you pass through the rod. That way it's done totally indiscriminately. In other words, you can't just simply go through your field, your flocks, and just simply say, well, I think I'll give that one to the Lord and that one, that one, that one. No, he wants them all to pass through the rod, and then you, every tenth one, you dedicate to the Lord, and you mark it off specifically as being for the Lord. That way, there's no manipulating the situation, because God knows just the way that our tendency is. So we just simply, if the tenth one happens to be your prized sheep, well, too bad. And if it happened to be your lame sheep, well, you lucked out. That type of thing, if you depending on how you want to look at it. Verse 32, for every tenth part of the herd of the flock, whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. He is not to be concerned whether it is good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. Or if he does exchange it, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. It shall not be redeemed. These are the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai. So in other words, anything that passed under the rod and you decided, well, gee, I want to exchange that. Well, you can't. Whatever you're going to exchange it with, that belongs to God too. This is a very, very difficult chapter, okay? But I think the overlying theme, is what is most important here, okay? And that's God is trying to emphasize to us, man, in our dealings with him and our relationship with him, he is always to be given, the utmost respect and the utmost honor and the utmost reverence in our dealing with him. We can't, it's just a shame and it's appalling that we have tried to bring God down to our level. And to the point where the old adage, familiarity breeds contempt. Familiarity can breed contempt right at the very altar of God. I had some guy come through my check stand today and he was paying his groceries, and he looked at this bill and says, do you know that we are the only country in the world that has this written on our currency? And it says, in God we trust. And I said, well, yeah, but it doesn't mean anything. Okay? Why doesn't that mean anything, in God we trust, on our dollar bills?
Because as a nation, we don't.
If this thing really meant something to us, do you think that we would have the problems that we're having today? Absolutely not. But the fact that we put on all of our dollar bills, in God we trust, to me, is a joke. Because why? Because we don't trust him. We have brought him down to our level, and we don't reverence him as God, as a nation, or as individuals, as families, or even in many churches today. And that's why we're in a mess today. And I think that that's what we got to keep in mind, especially in this chapter 27 of Leviticus, that God needs to be on the throne, and we, you know, we need to recognize that he is in charge rather than trying to bring him down to our level or trying to ascend to his level, saying, I'll be like God. There needs to be a fear of God. That's why it says, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Right? Mm-hmm. This is what this chapter 27 is dealing with. Have a reverence and a fear and respect for Almighty God. People, we've lost that today. Totally and completely. You know? Mm-hmm. And that's what I think it's trying to bring. Anyway, let's go ahead and close in a prayer.
Actually, John, yeah. Did I miss the explanation as to why a vow is over and above a tithe and an offering? Was that
Okay, yeah, it's just simply, okay, a tithe is required. A vow is not required. If you make a vow, it's simply purely done out of your own desire to please God, to honor God, to glorify God, to give to God. It's totally voluntary. There is absolutely no compulsion whatsoever. However, if you make that vow, then you keep that vow. That's what he's trying to stress. And to renege on that vow, to cheat on that vow, shows a lack of fear of God.